right now on HD2. For more information, go to WGTD.org or dial 564-3030.
This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Dwayne Olson, a retired member of the teacher education faculty at UW Parkside, Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Mike Kehoe, a retired substitute teacher and a current special education support volunteer at Bullen Middle School in Kenosha, and Chuck Wolbers, a transition and work experience teacher in the special education department at Tremper High School, also in Kenosha. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
I'm Dwayne Olson, your host today for Education Matters on WGTD HD, Gateway Technical College, Kenosha, Wisconsin, at 91.1 on your FM dial and 101.7 in Elkhorn and 103.3 in Lake Geneva. WGTD is a member of the Wisconsin Public Radio Network. Before we begin, I want to indicate that this program was recorded the previous Thursday. Our program today focuses on current issues in Wisconsin public education, with particular emphasis on urban education as found in Milwaukee, Kenosha, and Racine. My guest today is Mr. Alan Borsuk, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School. Alan retired in 2009 from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel after 37 years, the last 10 of which he wrote about education. As part of his activity at the Marquette University Law School, he now writes a weekly column on education for the Sunday Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Welcome again to Education Matters, Alan. I think this is the fourth time you have been my guest.
And I'm always glad to do it. Appreciate the chance.
And I really appreciate having you. Your most recent Journal Sentinel column this past Sunday, then, dealt with Wisconsin's revenue caps and their impact on education. Briefly summarize what has happened on those in the last few years for our listeners.
Yeah, I'll put the emphasis on briefly.
Okay.
Going back to the mid-1990s, revenue caps, which is a limit on how much school districts can collect in property taxes and state aid, were put in as a way to try to stem the, at that time, rather rapid rise in school spending state.
Right.
And they're still there today. Through most of the following years, they went up each year, if the total amount is about $10,000, they went up about 2%, which is to say $200 a year. And school districts could cope with that fairly well. Comes to 2011 and the whole Act 10 episode, which is one of the really important pieces of Wisconsin contemporary history. And not only did it Act 10 cut back, and or the events of that time cut back on the powers of teachers' unions greatly, but they also cut the revenue cap by 5.5%, which was a trade-off for employees paying more for retirement and health benefits. Since then, the most important part to me is that since then, expenses have begun to go up slowly, not hugely, but nonetheless there's some inflationary expenses, not only for employees, but utilities and insurance and all that kind of stuff.
Yes.
But the revenue caps have been kept very close to flat, so school districts statewide are increasingly being squeezed between increasing costs and not much increase in revenue.
Right. Okay. And I know that Racine Unified has been particularly hard hit in terms of this because Racine didn't go to the max on their budget back in 1994. That's when I was finishing up my term on the school board. And consequently, then we have then been even farther behind in terms of funding for the Racine Unified School District.
One of the peculiar things about the revenue cap system and some of the other steps that were taken is that it did give school districts an incentive to spend to the max.
Yes.
And actually punish them if they didn't in terms
yes.
of future revenue, which happened. There was one year that Milwaukee Public Schools didn't go to the max on the revenue cap, and you'd think everyone would say, hooray, we're saving taxpayers' money, but they really paid for it in following years, including simply in actual services and not just in terms of dollars.
And I know I was talking with the finance person with Racine Unified a few years ago, and he said, you know, we're already behind $50 million, and you know, it's probably been as many years since, you know, since he talked about it. So that's been really hard on the district.
So I'm sure that's true.
One of the things that you mentioned about current revenue caps is that wealthy school districts can more easily pass referenda to raise additional funds than poorer school districts like Milwaukee. It also strikes me that recent state legislation has called for funding from funds that would have previously gone to the school district. Am I correct in that perception that they're taking money from the school districts to fund these alternative programs?
You mean like charter schools and such?
Pardon?
Well, like charters and vouchers and such.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, that's true. And just to what degree that's a problem for school districts, you could have a really long debate about that, because money is taken out for these alternative forms of publicly funded education. The argument would largely be not over whether money is coming out of school districts for it, but if these students, let's say who would be in a charter school in Racine or somewhere, were in the public schools, there would be even more state aid going to them. So,
yes.
So then you'd say, oh, they're saving money, they're costing money. Like I said, you could have a big, long debate about it, but there's no question that ultimately loss of students means loss of money and energy in a school district, and you're seeing it in large part, in, you know, very vividly in Milwaukee, and you're probably seeing it in Racine in a way that's going to grow over the next few years.
Yes.
Declining enrollment is not a good thing for a school district.
And no.
These streams are offering ways for people to choose, and it is entirely driven by choice, to go elsewhere, and that has some consequences.
Exactly. Now, let's move on to the University of Wisconsin system. In the 2015-17 biennial budget that was just signed, the University of Wisconsin system sustained cuts of $250 million for this biennium, and tuition is frozen for the biennium as well. What do you see as the immediate and long-term impact of this?
Well, I don't have a very good crystal ball on that, and I'd throw in one other element, is that the language related to tenure for faculty was changed.
Yes.
And taken out of state law and put in the hands of the UW system. People who supported this said, oh, it's really not a change. You'd be really hard-pressed to find a faculty member on any campus in the UW system who would agree with that, I think. It was widely perceived as a undermining of tenure, and that this would become a major incentive for people to leave the system and a disincentive for people to join the system. I'm talking about faculty and especially prestige faculty.
Right.
So this is going to require a great deal of careful attention, and I don't envy the UW leaders on any campus in the state and in trying to maintain the quality of what they're aiming to do. The university system as a whole, and the Madison campus especially, because it is one of the premier learning institutions in the world, these are great assets to the state and great jewels in the possession of the state, and how carefully we keep these jewels polished and attractive is not a small matter. It's really crucial to the future of the economy of the state, among other things. So the people who, you know, the Republicans who made the cuts think the university can survive and that they're helping students afford education by holding down tuition and such. My guess is in the short term, the financial squeeze isn't going to be that hard. They do have the whole UW system has some reserves they can draw on to account for covering some of the reduction. But the real question is what's going to happen in the long run as far as the quality of these institutions, and nobody knows that yet.
Do you have any sense so what's motivating this defunding, if we can call it that, of the University of Wisconsin system? Do you have any sense for that?
Well, I I'm not always so good at guessing people's motivations.
Yes.
Interpreting them, but I think there, in general, the Republican leadership, the governor and the legislative leadership, feel that the university is costing a huge amount of money. There's been a trend away from public funding in the university system.
Yes.
Going back, I might add, to the last 2 years of Governor Jim Doyle, a Democrat, but he was the first one who proposed cuts in the budget, and it was simply because we don't have the money. At that time, it was major national recession.
Yeah.
I think you're going to be seeing it more and more around the country, and so Wisconsin may be, in a, some sense of the term, ahead of the curve in making cuts like this.
Leading
in
the
general,
pack.
There's been a trend away from public funding.
Yeah. I was just reading a letter to the editor in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel last week or earlier this week. Someone had written to the effect that every dollar invested in the UW system produces $24.4 in return. Now, I don't know how true that is, but apparently that had been a UW system figure that had been put out.
I've seen figures like that, and you know, frankly, there's no exact way to calculate that because a lot of it involves ripple effects that are not so easy to measure. So I think if you were sitting in the legislature, you might say, okay, fine, but I still got to pay the bills now, and,
yes,
and the return 30 years from now is not so easy to calculate.
Yeah,
so
right.
I'm not discounting that, but it is sort of a speculative piece of research.
And interestingly, I was just reading something from the Racine Education Association just last week that to the effect that we're spending more on prisons in the state of Wisconsin than on public schools. I don't know if you have any sense for that, but that I was kind of shocked by that.
I haven't looked that up. It's gone back and forth in the last bunch
uh-huh.
of years. It's close between the two. And it's mostly in terms of what's in the state budget, which is not the only source of education. I think in total, education is a higher center of spending than prisons.
Yes.
But what's in the state budget, I don't know. You know, the state prison population has actually gone down a little bit in
uh-huh.
recent years. So there's been some reining in of and there's a very interesting, this is off topic for us, there's a very interesting growing national trend, bipartisan, quite a few Republicans involved, to try to find ways to reduce prison populations, especially
yes.
for nonviolent offenders, because they're so expensive.
Right. Yeah, and I know the faith groups here in Wisconsin are really working hard at pushing a reduction in the prison population, too.
Yeah, you normally think of that as a, shall we say, left side initiative, but it's increasingly become a bipartisan matter for various reasons, including just cost savings.
Okay. In the last 4 years, two pieces of legislation have been passed by the Wisconsin State Legislature and signed into law by Governor Walker that directly impact Racine Unified. The first one is the expansion of state vouchers to include Racine Unified in addition to the Milwaukee Public Schools, and B, the recent legislation that calls for Racine Unified school board members to be elected by sub-district. Where is this legislation coming from? Is it coming from one of our state senator, Van Wongard, or is it with support of fellow legislators, or Mr. Voss, or for whom? From whom? Or?
Well, they're two separate matters. The voucher initiative, which started in 2011 with a couple years of phase-in in Racine, it was the first place in the state beyond the city of Milwaukee where vouchers were offered. And now it's available to an uncapped number of students in Racine. You know, that I think was more the product of a general agenda to increase voucher programs around the state, and Racine was the first destination beyond Milwaukee because it does have a concentration of low-income students, and the vouchers were aimed mostly in that direction. They still are, more so in Racine than in Milwaukee, in that they're capped at, I believe it's 175% of the federal poverty table for a household, which Milwaukee, it's 300% of the poverty table. So that was more of a general agenda of
okay.
expanding vouchers. The school district thing, frankly, I haven't worked on that much, but it did amaze me that here you stuck in the state budget, which you would think is supposed to be about fiscal policy.
Yes.
This matter, which had no public hearings, no airing of any kind, no consideration at the local level, by the school board or the Common Council or the Racine County Board or anything, you stick in this matter, which has obviously no fiscal impact, but it's a way to get things done in Madison, I guess, which I find really quite objectionable. And I believe it was driven by a member of the assembly or two from who represent some of the parts of the Racine United district that are outside the city of Racine.
Yes.
And I don't need to tell you there's a tension between those areas and the city of Racine areas, socioeconomic differences, but whole questions about where people want to send their kids to school. I think people in Sturtevant and such felt like they were underrepresented on a school board generally elected. I have no idea who's right or wrong or what's the best answer. I think sticking in the budget was just something that left my jaw open.
Yes, or even
wow,
coming.
What are they doing?
Well, and also, it seems to me it sets precedent for, so any legislator could ask for that for his school district or her school district and to have a precedent for it.
Unfortunately, and I do think it's really not very good public policy making.
Yeah.
The tool. There's lots of precedent for sticking stuff in the budget that has nothing to do with state spending whatsoever. Oftentimes involving education, also oftentimes involving any number of other subjects. It's the one thing that has to get rammed through the legislature, so you put everything in there that you can. And some of these things come out at 1:30 in the morning. A bunch of education agenda items were acted on by the Joint Finance Committee 2 years ago. There were major things happening, including creation of a statewide voucher option. At, I believe it was 4 or 4:30 in the morning, with no public airing. They just bring it out of the back room, plop it on the table, and pass it. And you say, goodness gracious, these people are certainly being kind to me and giving me material to write about. But as a way to make public policy, it's pretty strange.
If any other
government body in the state of Wisconsin did what the legislature does, they'd be in deep legal trouble because of closed proceedings. But the legislature exempted itself from the same rules.
I was reading the governor's memo dealing with what he had vetoed and so on and so forth, and he wanted, in one particular area, he was saying that this returned more power to the local people as it should. Well, this is quite the opposite of that.
Well, there's some items in the budget that you can say, oh, this helps local control, and there's some items in there you say, what are they thinking as far as local control? I mean, yes, this is you'd get the same argument from the city of Milwaukee officials, the mayor and such, over residency. And they say, this
yes.
is for us to decide, not for the state to decide, but they decided it. Is it illegal to do this? Not that I'm aware of. I certainly think the answer is no. Is it a good way to make public policy? And is it a matter of respecting local control? Not really.
Not really, yes. So on July 8th, Tony Evers, State Superintendent of Public Instruction, sent a 14-page memorandum to Governor Walker asking that certain pieces of legislation in the 2015-17 biennial budget be vetoed or partially vetoed. Would you comment, and I've got several of these that I've identified. Let's start with the elimination of CESAs.
I'm not sure they're not eliminating CESAs. They changed the funding and took away direct state funding for most of their budgets. So I think some more of it's going to have to come from school districts paying, or they're going to have to cut back. But yeah, there was a fairly serious cut at CESAs, and part of that I think is, I mean, how many people in the general public understand what a CESA is?
Yes.
And sometimes I don't myself. They're kind of a general service agency for school districts and. Every part of the state is part of a CESA. It stands for Cooperative Education Service Administration or something, agency. I think that's it. And they provide some training for teachers, some venues for getting people together. Best as I know, CESAs generally do pretty good work, but they're not. They're at a level and their nature that it's easy for people to say, why are we giving money to these folks? What do they do?
Yeah,
that's kind of what happened here.
I suppose because they're that agency that provides services to school districts, people themselves don't, the voters themselves don't feel what they are doing.
Correct, yeah. If you went around and did a public poll and asked people, what CESA district is your school district part of, I bet there wouldn't be 1% of people in the state who could answer that.
Right. Let's talk about the civics assessment requirement for high school graduation. That's an interesting one.
That's another one that's in the state budget. It has absolutely nothing to do with the state spending plan, although it might end up incurring some costs, but there's nothing in there related to revenue in the budget itself. It's an idea that's gained momentum, largely driven by a foundation in Phoenix, Arizona, and then with some supports from some other conservative organizations such as ALEC, the Legislative Exchange Council. And it's supposed to be a way of increasing students' awareness of civics. The idea is to give is to give every high school student in the state the same 100-question simple yes or no or multiple-choice type exam that is given to people as part of citizenship proceedings. And I think everyone across the spectrum is in favor of students knowing more about the American approach to government and civics and some basic things. I mean, there are questions on that test like what ocean is it off the east coast of the United States? Everyone thinks all kids should know that. The issue is to say it's a requirement for graduation. It is the first time Wisconsin has required students to pass any specific test to graduate. You know, 15 years ago, there was a whole long debate about having a high school graduation test in Wisconsin, and it didn't happen. We now have a high school graduation test, and it's this 100-question civics test that's used in citizenship proceedings. Is this a good idea? My guess is if it's taken seriously, and I don't know how it can't be taken seriously when it's in state law as a graduation requirement, it's going to be a pretty serious administrative burden on schools and even maybe on budgets. I mean, you say, well, are kids going to be able to take this home and do it on their own, which
yes.
the main author of the legislation told me that would be fine. I said, don't you think kids will cheat? And he said, oh, kids cheat all the time. Well, that's not a very good answer.
No.
And it does specifically say this is a requirement for graduation, so it's quite amazing.
I'm wondering if
it applies
if
to the class graduating in June of 2017, by the way. So that's the first time it'll be in effect.
Uh-huh. I'm wondering if State Superintendent Everts will take the governor to court on this. Do you have any sense for that?
There may be issues in the state budget that could end up in court proceedings.
Yes.
As to whether they're taking power improperly away from the Department of Public Instruction, which is created by the state constitution. I kind of doubt that one will be it. I don't think it's unconstitutional or illegal. I'm not a lawyer, even though I work
no.
in school. So I could be wrong about this, but whether it's a good idea or not is a different question.
Yeah. And just for the benefit of our listeners, we need to mention the fact that in the state of Wisconsin, and we are truly unique in this, is the state superintendent is elected separately of any other officer by the people of the state and responsible to the people of the state.
Wisconsin is the only state in the country with an elected chief state school officer, but without an elected state school board,
yes.
The Board of Regents. Most states have a state school board. Only a few don't have that, and among those, they don't have a state elected officer. So Tony Evers is a one-of-a-kind person. He is, frankly, correctly regarded as being more of a liberal Democrat, and that means he and the DPI were almost totally cut out of any of the action in the state legislature this past spring and on the state budget. They were like the last people to know what was going on.
Yes.
And in this message that you mentioned where Superintendent Evers asked for all these things to be vetoed, I'd have to go through them one by one, but I believe he struck out on every one of them. There might have been one minor one where the governor went along with him, but anything that had any consequence, he struck out, which was no surprise.
Yes, yeah, okay. Now, what about participation by homeschooled students in public school athletic and extracurricular programs? That's an interesting one, too.
Yes, it is. And there's an increasing number of actually, I'm not even sure that's quite factually true. If you add in virtual school students, it's definitely an increasing number. But I think there is a substantial number of students in the state who are being homeschooled. A lot of YMCAs and other organizations have created programs for homeschooled students to have sports and take part in teams and such because the service parents want, in many cases. Now there's an obligation for school districts to integrate these kids into their football and basketball, swimming teams, whatever it might be. The WIAA, the State Athletic Association, was quite upset about this because I think it's going to be an administrative problem.
Yes.
And create some inequities in what's required of athletes. But it's in there, and I assume it's going to happen. How many students is it really going to affect? I have no idea. Curiously, some of the homeschool people, the homeschool movement is not a unified situation. There's some sharp divisions over within the ranks of what the state should be doing or acquiring. And there are even some homeschool people who were opposed to this because they thought it spoke to entanglement with the state that they didn't want. But there was a particular legislator who wanted it, and he got it through.
Yes. Okay, is there any others of these items that Tony Evers was asking about that you would like to comment on? If not, we'll just move on.
Oh, there's some amazing things in the budget that Superintendent Evers asked to be vetoed. For example, the creation of a system in which the county executive in Milwaukee County, Chris Abley, will be able to in effect create his own kind of mini school district with a commissioner of education. That's one that may end up in court. And just what's going to happen on that, I don't know. But the Republicans, particularly State Senator Alberta Darling and State Representative Dale Kianga, put that in the budget. And Tony Evers asked for that to be taken out, which it wasn't. The governor left it in. There's other charter school action there which will be interesting to watch. The Waukesha County Executive was given the power to create charter schools. On your turf, very much on your turf, Gateway Technical was given the power to create charter school. Although there was a statement, I didn't speak to them myself, but I read elsewhere that at least for the foreseeable future, there's not an intention to act on this. They're not required to create charter schools.
No.
And I'll be surprised if anything comes out of Gateway Technical. In Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Area Technical College has had the power to create charter schools for more than 15 years and just never done it.
Yes.
UWM and the city of Milwaukee have done it, but MATC has not done it. And my guess is that's going to happen with Gateway Technical. They did not ask for this to be put in, if I'm correct. I believe I am.
For the benefit of our listeners, let me mention, too, that Gateway Technical College does own WGTD, that our station that we're broadcasting on here. So we need to make that clear to our listeners.
Yeah, like I said, I don't believe that it was requested in any way by Gateway Technical. Somebody just put it in. But that's the state budget process.
Well, and it seems to me that given everything Gateway has to do, and I think they do things pretty well, you know, in fact, I think very well, they've got a good reputation, for them to take on this added challenge would be certainly interesting.
Yeah, well, it wouldn't necessarily conflict. Even financially, it wouldn't necessarily be any obligation. I think UWM is able to do it without any spending of any student-related funds on that because the schools themselves have to pay a fee to the UWM Charter Office or the City Hall Charter Office or, for that matter, the Milwaukee Public Schools Charter Office. Nonetheless, it would be an expansion. I think the thought behind it originally was to find a way to give students more avenues of vocational and technical education, and then that wasn't quite flying, and they ended up narrowing it to Gateway Technical. But like I said, many amazing things happen in the course of the state budget.
There you go. Okay. Let's move on. As a complement to the voucher program, in its last session, the state legislature passed legislation allowing Wisconsin parents who send their children to private or parochial schools to deduct their costs up to, I thought, $10,000 for high school students and $7,500 for students below ninth grade. How much did that cost the state? Do you have any sense?
For K-8.
What?
I think it's $4,000 for K-8.
Okay.
What that really means, it's not a tax credit, it's a deduction. And what it really means is for high school, it can give parents a break of about $750. For K-8, it's more like $400 max in actual taxes paid.
Uh-huh.
And that's money they can then take and consider it to be applied to their tuition payments. There was no new action on that in this budget, which frankly kind of surprises me for all the other things that were going on. And I suspect the reason was because it does take some revenue from the state. It's been very quiet on that front.
Yes.
I've seen a report on how many taxpayers have used that deduction. To some degree, it's still quite new. If it's 2 years old, that means it's really only like 1 year old in effect.
Yes.
As far as data. I'll ultimately be very interested to see how many people are using this. And even a lot of the private school people felt that it wasn't enough to swing someone's decision. You know, there weren't going to be very many people who said, hey, I'm going to go to my public high school, but wait, I can save $750 in tuition. I think I'll go to the private high school instead.
Yes.
That it just wasn't enough to swing decisions. On the other hand, there are a lot of parents who aren't going to turn it down, and it is not limited by income or anything. It's open to anyone who cares to use it, as I recall.
Okay. Well, and that's one of those pieces of legislation that takes place and people really don't know about it unless maybe they're directly involved.
I'm curious how much public awareness there is of how many, you know, if you got an accountant, the accountant probably can tell you, hey, you're going to St. Catherine's High School in Racine or something, and you're paying tuition, you can deduct some of that.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's very widely, there isn't that much awareness of it. And it is, I might add, going back to an earlier theme, one of those things that came out of nowhere and appeared at 4 o'clock in the morning 2 years ago, and now it's in state law.
Yeah. At this point, I would want to remind our listeners that this is your host, Dwayne Olson, and you're listening to Education Matters on WGTD HD at 91.1 on your radio dial from Gateway Technical College, Kenosha, Wisconsin. Today, I'm visiting with Alan Borsuk, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School, about current developments in Wisconsin public education with emphasis on urban education. Before taking his position at Marquette, Mr. Borsuk wrote on education for the Journal Sentinel and currently writes an education column for the Sunday Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And now back to our program. And we're quickly getting out of time here. Let's move on to something that's unique to Racine here. Three communities that are part of Racine Unified, Caledonia, Mount Pleasant, and Sturtevant, have formed or are forming an organization to facilitate their withdrawal from Racine Unified. One of the first steps is to get the legislature to change its approach to withdrawing from an existing school district and forming a new district. Certainly one of the results would be to leave Unified with a larger percentage of minority students and students in poverty. Given what has happened to MPS these last years, what do you see this portending for the future of Racine Unified, the city of Racine, and the greater Racine community?
Well, I don't have, I should be clear that I don't have any real direct knowledge on this, and I haven't talked to the people involved.
And you don't have a crystal ball either.
No, that's for sure. But it's certainly in line with broader developments. In fact, you could say nationwide, not only in Wisconsin, the separation of well-to-do communities from lower-income communities and schools that are college prep-oriented from schools that don't have a very good record of getting kids on track for college. So the socioeconomics of this and some of the other dynamics certainly are in line with a lot of what's happened nationwide and some of what's happened in Wisconsin. I think the divisions between the city of Milwaukee and the suburbs are increased from what they once were, partly by, in fact, the number one reason would be the flight of the middle class from the city into the suburbs, and school selection was one of the big driving forces of that. I was just talking to someone the other day who said, I moved out of the city because I needed to for school reasons. So separating is very much in a trend that goes back probably 40 years at least. And in this particular state budget, you had like more or less the death knell for the Chapter 220 program, which has been a city-suburban voluntary integration program going back to the 1970s in the Milwaukee area. So there's lots of action similar to this that a middle class and above community like Sturtevant would want to say, we want our kids to stay out here. We want our decisions to be made out here and not in the city of Racine. Frankly, they got a lot of company. One of the books I've been reading lately that I highly recommend is by a guy named Robert Putnam called Our Kids.
Yes.
The American Dream in Crisis. And it's largely about that, how America is separated into its own little enclaves, many of them separated by income and class, more so these days than in the past, than by race or ethnicity. That in many cities, not so much in Milwaukee, but say Atlanta and places like that, the black middle class is separated from the black lower income neighborhoods, as the white middle class is separated from the black lower income neighborhoods, and that they it's more a matter of class and income than necessarily of race. But it's happening all over the country. And Putnam, who's famous for a book he wrote 15 years ago called Bowling Alone about the changing and weakening social fabric of America, Putnam feels this is a threat to opportunity for especially low-income kids nationwide.
Yes.
And to a large degree to the health of the American dream, where kids are so much pegged, their futures are so much pegged to where they're born, and they aren't really being given a chance the same way. So his underlying question is, the title of the book is Our Kids, and his underlying question is, are all kids our kids, or is just your own little niche where you're
yes.
onto your community and you don't care about anyone else the way people used to?
I saw him interviewed on the public television on the NewsHour one evening,
right.
And he was talking about, I think it was Gary, Indiana, where he was from originally. He was
talking about a little town called Port Clinton, Ohio.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah, near Toledo.
Okay, and he was saying that when he was in high school, and I think he graduated about 50, 52, somewhere along in there, that you didn't have any sense for class among the kids.
He uses Port Clinton and his childhood a lot in the book, that it was a time when everyone went to the same school,
yes.
everyone went to the same dances and played on the same sports teams, and there were friendships that crossed economic lines. There wasn't a sense of the right side and the wrong side of the tracks.
Yes.
And now you go back to a place like Port Clinton or the Milwaukee area or the Racine area, and you could make a list of many, many other places. There is definitely a separation between the suburbs and the city, between the well-to-do areas and their schools and other social institutions, and the lower-income areas and their schools and social institutions.
Right. Okay, let's move on and talk about ALEC a little bit. You mentioned ALEC previously, and
yes.
it's my belief that many, if not most, Wisconsin citizens aren't aware of the impact of the American Legislative Exchange Council on Wisconsin legislation. Can you describe ALEC for our listeners and discuss the overall development and impact of their model education legislation? And I guess I'm surprised the press doesn't call this to people's attention more. And do you know of any particular examples of ALEC-inspired education legislation?
Well, ALEC is very much a conservative-oriented organization of state legislators nationwide, and there are quite a few members of the Republican leadership in Wisconsin who are active in ALEC, who have been heads of committees there and so on. And some of the ideas you've seen around here related to school choice and certainly the reduction in powers of teachers unions and such would be stuff that would be in line with what ALEC promotes. you would find, you know, if you talk to some of the Republican legislators, they'd say, what is the big deal about ALEC? It's an organization. We get together. We talk about policy and so on. There's similar organizations on the liberal side, and no one gets so upset about them. And I have some sympathy for that in the sense that people who are backing legislation should take responsibility for the legislation they're backing and not point their fingers at outside organizations, because they're the ones who are voting for it. That said, ALEC, I think, is quite influential, as are some other, you know, conservative think tanks on the conservative side and probably some liberal ones on the liberal side. And people do look to them for specific language. You know, they'll give you a proposal for how to write your state standards and so on. You know, it's not a big secret. They are secretive in some ways, but it's not a big secret that they exist. In fact, Governor Walker just spoke at their national gathering in the Los Angeles area, I'm pretty sure about 3-4 weeks ago, as part of his presidential campaign, and sang the praises of ALEC. But the Walker agenda would be very much in line with the ALEC agenda, and some ideas, sometimes even some specific languages, are coming from organizations such as ALEC. So they're very much worth paying attention to. How nefarious are they? Depends a little bit on where you are in the political spectrum. You know, it's sort of like, what do you think of the Koch brothers? Which is one of the similar questions. Do you think the Koch brothers are buying the American political system? It depends a little bit on where you are on the political spectrum in looking at that.
Right. We're getting close to the end of our time here. Are there any other issues in urban education that you would like to discuss for our listeners before we have to cut out of here?
Well, ultimately, you can talk about a lot of specific policies, civics tests and changes in state testing, which are really interesting, or the Common Core we haven't gotten into, and so on. I think the two dominant things I would suggest people keep in mind when it comes to state policy and how it shows up at the local level are money and the tight rein on spending by local school districts coming from the capital these days, the capital in Madison, not so much the capital in Washington. So money and choice, because the choice climate is changing so much. You're not going to have a statewide option to have voucher programs. You're going to have more opportunities to have charter schools statewide, which are independent, non-religious schools, publicly funded. And what's going to evolve in terms of choice and its impact on the conventional and traditional public school system is a really, really important subject ahead. So those are the two things I would most urge people to pay attention to, money and choice.
Okay, thank you so much. To our radio audience, we say thank you for being with us today as we visited with Alan Borsuk, Senior Fellow in Law and Public Policy at Marquette University Law School. Mr. Borsuk currently writes an education column for the Sunday Journal Sentinel. Alan, I wish you well in your task of helping Journal Sentinel readers understand what is happening in the Milwaukee public schools as well as in public education in Wisconsin. Yours is a most important endeavor for our students, our citizens, and our state.
So. Thank you, and I would return the sentiments to you, and I appreciate you having this program, and
thank you.
Things go well for you.
Okay. If you'd like to hear Mr. Borsuk's previous Education Matters interview, go to WGTD's website, www.wgtd.org, and click on Talk at the top of your screen. Scroll down to Education Matters and click on To Learn More, and you're there. Mr. Borsuk's previous program aired on May 24, 2014. Finally, tune in next Saturday at 10:30 a.m. for another edition of Education Matters. This is your host, Dwayne Olson, thanking you for being with us today.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archived programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
Support comes from the Geneva Lake Theater Company, offering a Halloween-themed dinner show Friday, October 30th at Broggy in Williams Bay. A costume party will take place the following evening with more theater, hors d'oeuvres, drinks, and dancing. A family-oriented matinee on Sunday. Call 686-8016.
Support for WGTD comes from Vero International Cuisine in Racine on 6th Avenue near Monument Square, featuring American food with an international twist in a serene setting with intimate and exotic touches. Online at VeroInternationalCuisine.com.
Come fly with me. Come fly, let's fly away.
24/7 jazz on WGTD.